So we're in Luke's Gospel, chapter 20. This morning we're coming to the end of the chapter, verse 45. The Lord Jesus had come to Jerusalem, the capital city of the Jewish nation. He'd made it very clear who he was. He'd come in the name of the Lord as God's representative. He was there to set up God's kingdom and to rule over it. He was the rightful king who had come to claim the throne. He was the Messiah, the Christ, the ultimate king. He began to cleanse the temple from all the corrupt things that were going on there. He began teaching publicly in the temple. Great crowds gathered round him. He acted as someone with supreme authority. And the leaders, the official leaders of Israel, were furious. And they knew what they had to do. They had to destroy him. One way or another, they had to eliminate him. But they had a problem. They'd have liked to lynch him, but they couldn't, because he had crowds round him all the time, and the crowds would have jumped to his defence. If they couldn't lynch him, they'd have liked to arrest him. They couldn't do that either, for the same reason. And even if they did manage to arrest him, well, he hadn't actually committed any legal offence. None that the Roman authorities would take seriously. So what could they do? The leaders decided to take a more subtle approach. They decide that when he's teaching there in the temple, with the crowds around him, that they'll have experts on hand who can put questions to him. Questions of all sorts. Difficult questions. Probing questions. Trick questions. Questions that are designed to make him look a fool. We've been looking at some of those questions in the last few weeks. Some of the questions were designed to trap Jesus, to paint him into a corner where he'd finish up saying things that would sound like treason and get him in trouble with the Roman authorities. Some of them were just designed to make him look silly, to ridicule the things that he'd been teaching so that he'd be discredited with the crowds. But one way or another, the leaders thought that they could undermine Jesus publicly with their questions. They had experts who were very good at that sort of thing. In the translation that we're using, the ESV, they're called the scribes. In some translations, they're called the lawyers. In others, they're the teachers of the law. Whatever you call them, these were men who were the recognized experts on the Old Testament scriptures, and especially the books of the law in the Old Testament. These were men who knew the scriptures back to front and inside out. They knew all about the ways in which different people had interpreted the scriptures down through the years. They knew all the debates and all the arguments that people had had about what the scriptures meant and how they were to be used. And now it was the job of these scribes to give expert guidance to other people, to interpret the scriptures for others. And especially to show people how the Old Testament law should be applied in their generation. You know, every big company nowadays has its own expert lawyers on the staff. And it's the job of the lawyers to advise them, to tell the executives of the company what they can do and what they can't. Every government department has its own expert lawyers on hand to give advice. Well, that was the job that the scribes did in Jesus' time. And they weren't only there for companies and government departments, they were there for ordinary people. And they were the teachers who gave people instruction about how to stay the right side of the law, what the law would allow and what it wouldn't allow. They were the teachers of the law. But remember that the law they taught was the law found in the Old Testament. They were the Bible scholars of the day. They were the theologians. They were the professionals when it came to understanding the Bible. Those are the people we're talking about this morning. Whether you call them the scribes or the lawyers or the theologians, these are the people who are putting their questions to Jesus in chapter 20. What does Jesus say about them in verse 45? And in the hearing of all the people, he said to his disciples, "Beware of the scribes. Be on your guard against the scribes." He says it openly. He says it loudly. He says it publicly. He's speaking to his own disciples, but he says it so that the crowds can hear as well. Beware of the scribes. He lumps them all together. Some of the scribes were attached to the Pharisee party, some to the Sadducees, some to other groups. But as far as Jesus is concerned, they're all dangerous, and his disciples need to beware of them all. We know from other passages in the Gospels that there were particular scribes whom Jesus respected, who he thought were at least sincere, who were looking for the truth. Remember, he said to one scribe, "You're not far from the kingdom." But here, as he talks to his disciples and to the crowd, he doesn't make any exceptions. He just says, "Beware of them all." There are times when we've got to do that, haven't we? You might say to your child, "Watch out for Alsatians," or "Beware pit bull terriers," or whatever breed it might be that you're worried about. You just say to the child, "Watch out for them. They're dangerous dogs." Well, there are some perfectly well-trained Alsatians. There are some Alsatians that are very placid, very safe, who would never attack anyone. But that's not what you say to the child, is it? You just say to the child, "Watch out for them all. Don't trust any of them." There are times when you've got to be prepared to generalize. Cretans are always liars, evil beasts, lazy gluttons. That's what Jesus does here. He warned his disciples that the scribes were dangerous. "Watch out for them," he says. "Guard yourselves against them." I don't know how the disciples would have reacted to that warning. The disciples may already have realized that the scribes weren't men to be trusted. I mean, they've had a lot of run-ins with the scribes already since they started following Jesus. But I'm sure that as the crowd listened into this, there'd have been a lot of people in the crowd who would have been utterly shocked. Because the scribes, as a class, were hugely respected. There was a mystique about these men. People viewed them with awe. They were the gurus. They were the unchallenged experts. You know, a little while back there was a lot of publicity about Cheetham's, the music school here in Manchester, and about the way that certain tutors at Cheetham's exploited the girls in their care, particularly in the 70s and the 80s. And some of those girls, you know, have been interviewed by the press. And what came through was the way that they had given their tutors such total, unquestioned trust, something close to worship. As far as they were concerned, these men couldn't be wrong. You couldn't question anything they said or any request they made. They couldn't be doubted. They had this aura of infallibility, of superhuman power. And these girls just went along with whatever they said or whatever they demanded. Those of you who grew up in the Roman Catholic Church, you can remember the way, can't you, that the priests were viewed by ordinary people. You might be aware that the priest, viewed as an individual, wasn't a very nice man. Maybe he drank too much, maybe he had all sorts of obvious weaknesses. But still he had that mysterious authority. He was set apart from other men. You didn't challenge him. Florian's talked about the Orthodox priests in Romania, who are viewed in just that way still by many people there. And that was the way that the scribes were viewed by many ordinary people in Jesus' day. They were beyond reproach. A combination of huge learning and holy status. And yet Jesus says, they're dangerous. Now, I want us to think about three questions. Firstly, we're going to ask, how did Jesus describe these men? And then secondly, we're going to ask, why were they so dangerous? And thirdly, we're going to ask, how were the disciples to guard themselves against these men? So question number one, how did Jesus describe them? Well, it's there in verse 46. Jesus gives us there a vivid picture of these men and what they were really like, their character, their behavior. Three things he highlights. A, their vanity. They like to walk around in long robes. And they love being greeted in the marketplaces. And they love to have the best seats in the synagogues and the places of honor at feasts. Jesus knows what really motivates these men. They claim to be concerned about God, and that God's law should be made known, and that God's law should be upheld. They claim to be concerned about people, that people should be guided into good, right paths. But Jesus says the chief thing that motivates them is their own vanity. They love the limelight. They love the respect, the recognition, the honour that their job brings them. They're performers, and they love their celebrity status. They love to have everybody looking at them when they walk past. They revel in it. I wonder how many of the scribes knew that about themselves. The heart is deceitful above all things, desperately wicked. Perhaps some of these scribes would have been shocked to hear that about themselves, because they'd never been conscious that that was their real motivation. We all hide our motives from ourselves, don't we? We can con ourselves that we're doing something for God's sake, or for the sake of other people, when really we're doing it for our own pleasure, to fulfill our own ambition, to impress other people. Perhaps some of these scribes honestly believed that they were motivated by a concern for God's glory. But Jesus looks into the human heart, and Jesus knows the truth. They're not concerned about God's glory. They're concerned for their own glory. We have to be sure not just of what we're doing, but of why we're doing it. And that doesn't only apply to religious work, Christian work. It applies to everything. Whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do it for the glory of God, says Paul. A Christian student ought to be able to say, Yes, I'm determined to get the best results I possibly can. But I'm not doing it to win applause. I'm not doing it to boast my self-esteem. I'm not doing it because I want a big career. I'm doing it for God's pleasure and God's glory. And the same is true for a Christian sportsman, or a Christian plumber, or a Christian housewife, or a Christian politician. The scribes were motivated by vanity, but I suspect most of them weren't conscious of it. We have to search ourselves and we have to ask, what motivates us? The next thing that Jesus highlights about the scribes and their character B, their greed. He says they devour widows' houses. They don't just love applause, though that's very important to them. They love money. And they make themselves rich by exploiting vulnerable people. They'll batten on to a wealthy widow. She's lonely. She's sad. That makes her vulnerable. She feels she needs spiritual help, spiritual guidance, spiritual instruction. What she really wants is just somebody who'll come round and pay her lots of attention. And this scribe is more than willing to give it. He's very willing to visit her home regularly. He's very willing to offer her counselling, the regular help she needs. And if she wants to make generous gifts to him, well, I mean, it wouldn't be right to refuse them, would it? I mean, if she wants to leave everything to him in her will, well, that's God's providence, isn't it? He must have moved her heart. And so the scribe makes a woman like this dependent on him. He uses that aura we were talking about earlier to enrich himself at her expense. She's ready to accept any advice. She's ready to follow any hints he gives her, whether it's about spiritual matters or money matters. Jesus is describing here what really happened. This isn't an imaginary description. He says this is true of the scribes as a class. They are wealthy and they make themselves wealthy at the expense of the most vulnerable people. You know, this is one of the accusations most often thrown at religious leaders today by atheists and secularists and people who just don't like Christianity. They say, you can't trust them. They're all out for money. Well, they've got a point, haven't they? Jesus warned that there are many religious leaders for whom that is true. It was true of the scribes as a class. Jesus says we should distrust religious leaders who are obviously making money out of their religious position. He says we should distrust religious leaders who are enjoying a comfortable lifestyle paid for by others. And that applies whoever they are. If you see an evangelical pastor who has a lifestyle far beyond the reach of most of the people in the church he pastors, then you have got no reason to trust that man, however spiritual he may sound when he's talking. We're supposed to be followers of Jesus. And Jesus was the man who, when he came to the end of his life, the only property he had worth arguing over were the clothes he had to stand up in. He had no home. He had no regular income, and whatever money was given, he refused to take charge of it. It went into a common purse looked after by somebody else. When Jesus made this charge against the scribes, no one could point back at Jesus and say, well, what about you? If anyone could have used his aura, his charisma, to make himself rich, it was Jesus, and he was penniless. And then the last thing Jesus highlights about the scribes, the hypocrisy. He says, for a pretense, they make long prayers. He talks about this elsewhere, especially in the Sermon on the Mount. They pretend to pray. When they're in public, they pray long, impressive prayers. But in private, they hardly pray, or they don't pray at all. So their public praying is simply a lie. It's just an attempt to impress other people. They're not praying because they really want to be in touch with God, because they love to talk with God, because they want things which only God can give, and they believe that he'll give them. They're praying as a show. They switch their praying on and off as it suits them. Again, I don't know whether they themselves were conscious of this. It's possible to do something so often that in the end you're not aware that you are doing it. Some of them maybe had never prayed real prayers in their life. Maybe they'd never had any inkling what real praying is. Maybe they had no idea that prayer is supposed to be real communication, a real engaging with God. Maybe they really thought of prayer as a sort of public performance, like playing a violin or doing a juggling act. You know, lots of people do think that that's what prayer is. It's all they know about prayer. I once saw a quote from an American newspaper reporting on a public meeting where a minister was asked to pray. And the reporter said he prayed one of the most eloquent prayers ever offered to a Boston audience. And that was it. It was a public performance offered to the audience. That's the way most people think of prayer. Maybe these scribes would have said, we're doing our duty. People need to hear public praying, and we're the people who do it. In the end, it doesn't really matter whether they realized it. Their praying, in fact, all their religion, was hypocrisy. It was play acting. It was performance. It was false. So they're vain, and they're greedy, and they're hypocrites. They can be all those things and yet look wonderful. They can be all those things and still sound holy and spiritual. Which brings me to the second question. Why were they so dangerous? How could they become a danger to the disciples and the crowds? If Jesus has to say to his disciples, beware of them, be on your guard against them, clearly Jesus thinks that they could be a danger to the disciples and to the crowd who are listening in. But how are they going to be a danger? Well, at one level, you can see straight away why they were dangerous for people. The people who trusted them. We've just said they were greedy, unscrupulous men who could persuade themselves that whatever they did was right and good. They were dangerous for widows, weren't they? That was obvious. Widows who trusted them found themselves exploited and robbed. Countless vulnerable people have found themselves exploited damaged, robbed by religious leaders who are just like these scribes. Leaders who have a religion, and in one sense their religion is sincere, they believe it themselves, they take it seriously, but it's driven by selfish, twisted motives. Some faith healers are just con men who know that they're lying to get money out of their victims. But some, I believe, never set out to be that. I think some of them start out believing in their own claims, but they still finish up exploiting the sick and the grieving and the most vulnerable people, basking in their celebrity status, getting money out of people who can't afford it, turning religion into a public performance and one that pays good dividends. All through the centuries, vulnerable young people have been exploited in other ways by powerful religious leaders. It's not only in music schools, secular music schools, that pupils get abused. It's in church schools. It's in monasteries and seminaries. It's choir boys, it's laundry girls. We've had such horrifying exposés in the last 15 or 20 years, haven't we? Of the way that modern day scribes have used their power, have used their authority to exploit the young people who were overawed by their status. The newspapers today, I always glance at them when I get up on a Sunday morning just to see if there's some story that I ought to be aware of, that we ought to be praying about. Well, the papers today are full of one more story of a 47-year-old married minister, a youth missioner in a country village, and his affair with an 18-year-old girl from the youth group. And she finished up in a psychiatric ward. He's just had to face a church court. And of course you get the comments then from people who are hostile to all religion. This is typical of the type of behaviour we get from the God lot. They're from the planet Zog, where behaving bizarre is the norm. It's good to know the religious mob are on the way out. They've had a good run, but they're all sussed by the discerning now. Well, we don't need that sort of comment, do we, to tell us that there are plenty of religious leaders who can't be trusted, who will exploit the vulnerable. Jesus told us so. Watch out for the scribes, he said. And we need to say that firmly and clearly to our children, to vulnerable people of all sorts. There's no virtue in naivety. We have to say, don't trust anyone just because he's supposed to be a religious leader, just because he can pray long, eloquent prayers, just because he seems so holy and caring. Some of these people are very dangerous, and they'll exploit you. They'll exploit you in one way or another. The aspect that Jesus focuses on here is those who exploit people for money. There are plenty of other ways in which religious leaders have and do exploit vulnerable people. So we're talking about that sort of danger. But we're not just talking about that sort of danger, are we? After all, Jesus was talking to his disciples. Surely most of them aren't going to start throwing money at the scribes, allowing themselves to be exploited in that way by the scribes. No, but that's not the only way in which the scribes could be dangerous. Remember that these scribes were involved in a conspiracy to get Jesus murdered. And that's what lay behind all their questioning. They were trying to set God's son up for a lynching or an execution on trumped-up charges. These men, these scribes, were filled with hatred and anger and bitterness against Jesus. They wanted Jesus dead. That's what was behind the facade, this facade of sanctity, of concern for God's law. And if they're prepared to treat Jesus that way, then they will treat Jesus' disciples that way. So Jesus is warning his disciples, watch out for these people. Because behind all the holy appearance and the profound intellectual manner, they're capable of savage hatred and wicked deceit and utter ruthlessness. If you once challenge them, if you just cross them for a moment, you watch out because they'll persecute you. You see, the disciples can't afford to assume that these scribes were sincere, truthful men. They weren't. I mean, here they were turning up in Jesus' congregation, pretending that they had important questions, that they really wanted to learn, calling Jesus teacher. And actually, they were just gathering evidence so they could stab him in the back. They were intent on destroying him. Jesus has got reason to say to his disciples, watch out for them. Be on your guard. Don't trust them. You know, nowadays there are many evangelical Christians who have decided that they can cooperate, they must cooperate with anyone who says the right things, anyone who seems to be sincere, anybody who's standing up for God and for Christianity. We're told, don't be suspicious. Just take people at face value. Accept the fact that though they may differ from us at various points, these people are sincere at least. Well, Jesus says exactly the opposite here. He says, don't trust the scribes. Because some of them will turn out to be people who really hate me and will hate you for being faithful to me. But then there's another danger that the disciples and the crowds needed to be aware of. And it's this, that the scribes could confuse them. That they could confuse and muddle their thinking. Remember, the scribes were Bible teachers. They were theologians. And most people, when they listened to the scribes, found their teaching very persuasive. They seemed to have such a thorough knowledge of the Bible. They seemed to have such scholarship. They seemed to be approaching the Bible so carefully, so rationally. And most people who listened found themselves agreeing with whatever the scribe was saying. Well, he certainly sounds as if he's got it all clear. But now Jesus has just been debating with the scribes. And what have we seen? We've seen him exposing all sorts of gaps and all sorts of complete errors in their thinking, and especially in their understanding of the Bible. They've never understood the parable of the vineyard from Isaiah. They've never understood the passage about the cornerstone from Psalm 118. They've never understood the passage about the stone that crushes things to smithereens in Daniel. They've never understood the passage in Exodus which says that he's the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. They've never understood Psalm 110 where David speaks about his Lord. Jesus takes them through all these passages in the course of this chapter, And in each one of them, he shows that these scribes, for all their learning and all their scholarship, have got them wrong. And they've been teaching other people wrong. They're not reliable guides. They're not reliable teachers. They may have great learning. They may be brilliant scholars. But they're not safe to follow. And why not? Why can't they see things straight? Why can't their biblical exegesis be trusted? Answer, because they're biased. There are some things they don't want to see in the Bible. And consciously or unconsciously, that warps their thinking. Remember, what motivates these people? Vanity. So they're not going to deal squarely, are they, with any passage in the scriptures that they would find humbling, humiliating? Greed. So they're not going to explain truly any passage which condemns greed and exploitation, are they? Hypocrisy. So they're not going to exegete accurately any passage which explains what real prayer is. They're not going to be capable of understanding it. Hatred. Hatred for Jesus. So they're not going to understand all the passages which talk about Jesus. The cornerstone, the stone which grows to fill the whole earth, David's son and Lord. Their eyes are going to be firmly shut whenever the Old Testament speaks about Jesus, because they can't afford to open them. And they talk about Jesus everywhere, those scriptures. So the reading, their reading of all the scriptures is going to be warped by their own sinful motives and desires. Theologians, experts on the Bible, religious leaders, all like to pretend that they have no biases, that they are simply approaching the text objectively, that they're willing to follow the truth wherever it leads. And it's not true. People are biased by their own sinful agendas. A well-known Christian preacher may be regarded as the outstanding pulpit expositor of our generation. A married man preaches what the Bible has to say about marriage, relationships, the fact that God has created human beings, male and female. But meanwhile, this man is aware that he's tempted by an abnormal attraction to other men. He doesn't confess it as sin. He doesn't put it to death by grace. Instead, he allows a close, increasingly obsessive relationship to develop with a younger man. And he hides from his wife the extent of that relationship. And then the day comes when he decides he can't live without this man. And he's got to leave his wife and move in with this man. But it's going to be a completely celibate relationship, because the Bible clearly condemns abnormal physical relationships. But from that point, he starts looking again at what the Bible has to say about such relationships. And what a surprise! Within a short time, he discovers that he's been misinterpreting the Bible all along. That actually there is nothing in the Bible to forbid homosexual partnerships. Do you see? He can't think straight about Scripture because he's biased by his sin. He's determined to see what he wants to see. And he can't see what he can't afford to see. Jesus says to his disciples, and he says to the crowd, watch out for the scribes. Not just because they'll exploit you, not just because they'll persecute you, but because they'll confuse you. They'll teach you falsehood. And what they say, especially when they're quoting the Bible, may sound very plausible, but it'll be twisted by their own sinful agenda. Jesus wants his disciples to have a proper wariness about people who claim to speak for God, and even people who use the Bible. He says, be on your guard. Don't just have the doors open to say, well, I can listen to anybody. Well, you know, we can gain insights from all sorts of sources. Some of you will have heard of Don Carson. I think he's one of our finest theologians. A man who's Reformed and Baptist by conviction. And a man who's highly respected in academic circles. I was dismayed when Don edited a book, a Festschrift, a collection of essays written in honour of one of his teachers, Barnabas Lindas. Barnabas Lindas, radical liberal, denying the historicity of so much of the New Testament. A Franciscan monk. Don edits these essays in his honour. So he's telling the world, here's a man you must honour, here's a man you must respect. It's not the language of Jesus, is it? Jesus is saying, watch out, be on your guard. Don't honour men who are warped in their reading of Scripture. Jesus wants us to have a proper wariness about people whose reading of Scripture is warped by their own sinful agendas. And then one last danger. It's this, that the scribes could corrupt them. Here are the disciples, and they're in Jerusalem. They follow Jesus, the preacher from Galilee, the radical Messiah. And what's it brought them? It's not brought them money. It's not brought them status. It's not brought them applause. They're no richer than when they left home. They're not wearing long robes. And here they are now in Jerusalem, seeing these men, moving among them, discussing with them. How easy it would be for the disciples to start admiring them, to start thinking this is normal, to start feeling that in some way it ought to be like this, that those who are speaking for God should be gaining that sort of respect, should have people giving them the best seats in the synagogues and the places of honour at feasts. How easy it would be for the disciples to start taking on the values of these men. Four dangers. The scribes could exploit you. The scribes could persecute you. The scribes could confuse you. Most dangerous of all, the scribes could confuse you. Could corrupt you. You could finish up thinking like them, behaving like them, modelling yourselves upon them, thinking that their sort of religion is normal religion. I said there would be three questions. My last question was this, very briefly. How can the disciples guard themselves against the scribes? Jesus says they must. Jesus says you must beware of the scribes. You must have your guard up against them. But how are they going to do that? Well, isn't it obvious? By staying close to Jesus himself. If they're staying close to Jesus, then, and if they're modelling themselves on Jesus, and if they're listening to Jesus, then the scribes aren't going to succeed in ruining them, are they? They need to be taking Jesus as their great teacher. They need to be taking Jesus as their great example of lifestyle. They need to be letting the thinking of Jesus shape their thinking. They've got to be close to Jesus himself. What sort of teachers do we need? What sort of teachers should we trust? Teachers who bring you close to Jesus. Teachers who make much of Jesus. Who lead you to admire Jesus supremely. And to worship Jesus only. And to adore Jesus passionately. And to trust Jesus completely. And to obey Jesus at every point. You're safe with teachers like that, aren't you? Teachers who bring you to Jesus Christ himself all the time. These scribes were bringing people to themselves all the time. They were encouraging people to look to them, to trust them, to model themselves on them. That's why you had to be on your guard against them. What we need are teachers who will bring us to Christ all the time. That's where we're safe. We're safe when our eyes are focused on him. We're safe when we're listening to him. We're safe when we're worshipping him. Wasn't it John Newton who wrote, I should have looked up the quote before I came out, "What think ye of Christ?" That's the test to try both your state and your scheme. These scribes, they had passed their verdict on Christ. We don't want him. What we need are teachers who are saying Christ is everything. Teachers who enlarge your view of him, who make you think more highly of him all the time, who are giving you fresh glimpses of him and giving you fresh reasons to adore him and love him with all your heart. How do you guard yourself against the scribes, the false teachers, the corrupters? By staying close to Jesus.